As terrifying as it was, and as hard as it was to leave all my friends and family behind, I had to do it. It was the opportunity of a lifetime.
This is the Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes.
Growing up in the English Midlands, Georgina Hines defied academic norms, discovering her passion for the arts in a technical college. Her journey reflects the transformative power of parental support and prioritizing passion over conformity. From childhood struggles to professional success, Georgina's story is a testament to embracing individuality. Her career trajectory highlights the importance of internships, networking, and mentorship. Working with industry giants like MacKinnon and Saunders and collaborating with Tim Burton shaped her career and honed her craft. Delving into the intricacies of puppetry, we explore armature making, resilience, leadership in creative teams, and the culmination of all her training coming together in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. Georgina's experiences offer a rare glimpse into the elusive world of stop-motion animation. Here's our conversation with Georgina Hines.
Why don't we start with young George? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in England, in the Midlands of England, a place called Nuneaton, which is close to Coventry and Birmingham. Feel very lucky to have grown up there because I never had the chip on my shoulder that I was either from the north or the south. Midlanders just kind of have to meld into whatever environment they land in.
Were you always artistic?
I was, yeah. And it's funny, I knew straight away as a kid what I was good at and what I was really not good at. And I think, like most artists, I would probably have an ism beginning with the letter A nowadays. I like to say I've got asparagus. But basically, at school, I wasn't great at academia. I had attention issues and reading, writing issues. I would probably be classed nowadays as being slightly dyslexic. But it was more to do with sort of concentration. If there was any noise around me, I was way more sort of like interested in the noise rather than the maths in my maths book. But put a pencil in my hand, put a sewing machine in front of me or a needle or a sculpting tool, and I was away and in total focus. And I was very lucky that my family, they saw that straight away in them. And my dad was of a generation where men were supposed to go out and be breadwinners and they were expected to do a certain thing. And he'd always been a bit of a rebel, but he did kind of toe the line and do that. But then my mum was a very smart woman in the sort of like the 50s that she was looking to go to university. And all the teachers, she was like head girl. She was head girl of the same school that my dad was actually kicked out of because he was too disruptive. He was a bad boy and she was the like teacher's pet. Yeah, opposite. But basically she ended up against her teacher's sort of like advice. She went and studied physics, which in the 50s was a big deal for a woman. What I had with that was two parents that had always skirted the lines of what's expected and the norm. And they liked the fact that they did. And when I showed talent in the arts, they just said, well, that's what you're good at. Just do it. So there was no pressure from my family to do the academic route of, and become a bank. Like, I had friends that I went to school with who were the really smart ones and they're still in the same hometown and they work in the bank or they do, whereas I was able to just spread my wings and use my talents that I was born with and not have to clutter my brain trying to readjust myself to, a world that I wasn't made for.
Was it hard being, kind of this artistic kid in a place where perhaps art wasn't appreciated as much until you made it to art school?
Yeah, it was difficult. I don't think anybody ever really condemned me for being good at art and nothing else. But I think what kept me going was my personality, because I've just got a very open, friendly personality. And I was put on this planet to kind of please people. So I would try and please them, even if I couldn't read or write. I'd smile and I'm sorry kind of thing. So school was not easy because I constantly felt a little bit of a failure. But I got through it somehow. And the school it was a time where part of your school curriculum was art. Art was seen as an important part. So I did have these art classes and I did excel at them. And then I was actually, weirdly, I was always really sporty and really good at sport. So I was good at a couple of things that gave me hope. And then actually being in England, when you'd finished school and O levels, you either went to a college to do A levels, which is still quite school-like. It's focusing what you're going to be good at, basically. So they would have to take two sort of serious subjects. So you'd biology and physics, or you'd do history and English, or something like that. So I decided not to go to that college, and I went to a more technically based college, which was a hands-on college, and it had a 2-year course, and it was called a 2-year general art and design course, where basically is exactly what it says. I went straight from school. First year was just playing with all the different art forms. You've got a photography class, a life drawing class, a jewelry class, a ceramics class, a print class. So basically, it was aimed at people like me that wanted to get into the arts but didn't know where to focus. And that's where I really found my feet with, realizing, oh, I'm good at all of these things. Finally, I left school and I got into this place where I was good and could have gone in multiple directions.
And what was it there that really spoke to you?
Well, that was my problem. Sculpting, costume, fine art drawing, painting, they all spoke to me and I was really confused. And it was actually outside of the college world. My dad was a part-time antique dealer, collector and antique dealer, and he used to drag me to these antique fairs against my will. And I told him I was going to have everything modern when I'm a grown up, everything in my house is going to be modern. I hate old things. And one day I went to one of these, yeah, I was a rebel. I went to one of these antique fairs with him and came across this old Victorian doll. And I had always been a doll kid growing up. I'd had dolls, I'd made their clothes and everything, but I'd never seen anything like this. It was sort of, a porcelain head and old original Victorian clothes and everything. And I showed such an interest in it. My dad was like, oh my God, I've got a hooked on something. So he bought me this doll, and that started a new passion for me. And I started to collect and restore old dolls at the same time as I was at art college. So, and then the more I got into the old doll thing, I went to a doll fair, and there was an art doll maker there. And I was like, oh my God, art doll making? I could do that. I like sculpting. I like making clothes. So I went to my art foundation teachers and said, I know what I'm going to do. At the end of my foundation, I'm going to leave college and I'm going to set up my own business making dolls. Now, take yourself back to the sort of 70s, 80s when most art lecturers were hippie fine artists that wore Jesus sandals and the hair was down to here. And I come along and go, I'm going to leave and make dolls. They could not get their head around this. I literally was told, that is twee. You are way too talented an artist to waste your time making dolls. Go away and think about something you do want to do. And I was like, I do want to make dolls. How can they So it was me going home that night and really kind of like sitting there going, basically, how can I get around my art lecturers and what they want of me, but still do what I want? And I came up with this, I thought, brainwave. Wait a minute, puppets are kind of an artistic form of doll in the art world. You know, they perform, they act, but there's all these different kinds of puppets. I wonder if I like spoke to them about getting into puppet making, and that is how my career started. The next day I went in and I said, okay, I've been thinking about it, and actually, what about puppet making? It just seems much more, so it has more avenues to go down. And they went, oh, we love it. You could study shadow puppetry from Bali. And you know, they got totally into it. Then I was like, shit, okay, well, I know nothing about puppet making. And I gave myself a crash course. I went to the library and got every book that there was, because it was before Google, every book there was on marionette puppets and the history of puppetry. And then I found that there was an exhibition at Birmingham Museum on puppets, marionette puppets. And then I went to the video store because I thought, well, I'm going to see if there's anything at the video store puppet related. And that's when I saw the video Dark Crystal for the first time. And that blew my mind because that was, to me, everything I wanted to do in essentially making dolls, but dolls that come to life on the screen. So that was it. That's what triggered me. And then I was like, well, I need to go to college to study this kind of puppet making. There's no college courses that do that kind of puppet making. So I was trying to find a university, an art course that would allow me to do that as part of the curriculum. So I actually went to Manchester Polytechnic on a trip to visit the textiles course because I thought, well, textiles, maybe I can, you know, because I'm going to stitch a lot of these puppets, maybe I can adapt that course to this. And when I got there, it was very textile based, and not many people did anything other than textiles. But a friend of mine wanted to go and do the film, and he wanted to be a producer. So he wanted to go and look around the film and TV college. I said I'd go with him because at that point I was like, well, I'm not coming here. I don't want to do a textiles course. And there was a young guy who was on the film and TV course, but on the design side, which I didn't even know there was a design side to the film and TV course. And he had a room full of Jim Henson Dark Crystal style puppets. I walked past this room and literally stopped and went, where are these from? Can you make puppets like that here? And they went, well, we've never done it before, but Pete Brook, he's got a work placement at a local animation studio, and he's just been down at the Creature Workshop, Henson's Creature Workshop, and they're helping him with his film. And I'm like, okay. And that's it. I got home. I applied only to that one course. I made several puppets. I made a papoose that I carried my puppet attached to me in a papoose into my interview. I'm like, I am going to get into this course because I want to make those. And the irony of it was, I did get into the course. And then when the course actually sort of like started, the curriculum had nothing to do with animation or puppetry. He'd just done that himself. And I very quickly realized, oh, I've got to do that myself. So I followed his footsteps and got into the local animation studio. So that was actually the first time I knew anything about stop motion animation. You know, I didn't know that that was a thing you could do. But there was Cosgrove Hall Studios was based in South Manchester, which is where the university was. Initially, I think I got a tour of the studio when they were filming Wind in the Willows, and then asked if there was any way I could get a work placement. And because Pete Brook had put in, this guy had put in a good word for me, they gave me like a couple of weeks' placement, and they all got to know me, and they went, oh, well, if you need any help with your puppets, you know, you can. So I ended up pretty much staying there for doing an apprenticeship there, making the puppets for my degree piece and learning the trade of stop motion. And also realizing that most of the kids' TV I'd grown up on that I loved was stop motion. You know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, that was stop motion, and that was stop motion. Yeah.
It seems like you worked really hard at getting this degree where you could have just, forgotten school altogether and just went right into the career. Was there a reason why you pursued that so much?
Well, it was really because until I got to university, I didn't know how to get my foot in the door. My university course opened up all the doors for me. The reason I went to university was everybody told me I'd got to go to university to study, so to focus my skill set so that I could get into the industry. And I knew I wanted to make puppets at that point, but I didn't even know stop motion animation puppets were an option. I was like, I want to go and do Dark Crystal, but I didn't, the only way I could see I could get there was to go to university first. And it kind of paid off. I didn't end up doing Dark Crystal. I ended up hiring Toby Froud, who was the baby in Labyrinth. And
So you're apprenticing at the studio. You're working on your final film. Can you talk a little bit about that process of, finding your people, starting your career? Like once, as soon as you graduated, like assuming you have like a graduation film, do you use that to get a job or do you just stay at the studio because you've already been there?
I was very lucky, and and that time that I was at college, firstly, I had all of £1,250 overdraft when I left my 3 years of university, and that was stressful for me. And I know kids that have got hundreds of thousands of dollar debts hanging around when they leave university. But basically, yeah, another so. My career, unknown to me, was really established before I left co college, because university. Because, as I said, at the end of the so it's a 3 year degree course. At the end of the first year, I had already done my first work placement at an animation studio. They had become my friends and mentors. They then said, "Come back and we'll help you make your puppet for your second year film." So they did. They showed me how to mold make. They invested time training me. Then my third year film, I decided to do live action, like Dark Crystal. So I fabricated a lot, but they let me fabricate half of it at the film studio. So I was there on and off for 2 years, getting to know them. I became part of their family. They became part of my animation family. And then at the end of that, I had actually done summer work between my second and third year. They paid summer work at the studio. And when I left, there wasn't any work, but a friend of a friend down in London was doing a commercial. So they put me forward to do that commercial. So I went down to London, and before that commercial had even finished, I got a call from the puppet workshop at Cosgrove Hall, and they were like, "Oh, we've got a new TV series, and we've got a position for you. You want to come back?" So I did. And I mean, so the interesting thing as well, I mean, this is how in not incestuous, but how small our world is. The head of the puppet department at Cosgrove Hall was Peter Saunders, and his head armature mold maker was Ian McKinnon at the time. So when Cosgrove Hall as a company dissolved, it shattered into many smaller companies. That's when Pete and Ian set up McKinnon and Saunders. Who, of course, then I worked with for nearly sort of, well, 12 years. And then I'm still working with them today on projects. So that all started going to Manchester and meeting them all, yeah, on that college course.
You were clearly like really open to taking chances and like getting out into the world, but you're at McKinnon for like you say almost 12 years. What prompts you to leave and traverse across the ocean?
There was no intention of ever leaving. We were growing together, and we had Most of the work we did in the first few years at MacKinnon and Saunders was TV and commercials. And then the phone went one day. I answered the phone and it was Tim Burton's office in New York. And I nearly dropped the phone. And I went, oh, hello, yes. Can we speak to Peter Saunders or an Ian MacKinnon, please? And I, can please hold the line? Trying to be a secretary type and then go, oh my God. You know, I was very excited. Anyway, that was the first phone call for Mars Attacks. So we worked on Mars Attacks. We made 70 odd functioning puppets for Mars Attacks. And I was supposed to be coming out to America to oversee the maintenance while they were filming Mars Attacks, when the big decision was made that they weren't going to film it with stop motion after all, and they all went to computer animation. So fast forward 10 years, which are the 10 years that I worked at MacKinnon's on more TV shows and short films and everything. The phone went again 10 years later, and it was Tim Burton's office again. It was actually Warner Brothers this time. And they had got the contract of Corpse Bride. So, and Tim had always said after Mars Attacks that if his his Russian fairy tale ever came off, he would be back in touch with us. So we did work on Corpse Bride. We made all of the puppets in Manchester. And then myself and a small group of the puppet team went down to London for a year to oversee the maintenance of the puppets, to work with all of the animators. So the group of people that was brought together to work on Corpse Bride, they were all stop motion puppet animation people, but they were from all over the world. They had to bring people from all over to crew up this feature. And it was the first feature that had happened since, there'd been a run of Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach and Monkey Bones, but then there had been this like drought of stop motion features for about 10 years. So you can imagine bringing people together to work on Corpse Bride. It actually brought people from San Francisco, from Portland, Oregon, all of that, from Aardman, from Bristol, all of these people came to and met on Corpse Bride. So I got to meet a lot of Americans who were either working at Will Vinton Studios or were working freelance down in San Francisco. And when Corpse Bride came to an end and we were all like, well, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, I think I'm probably going to go back to Manchester. You know, that's my life. So, but it would have been really hard to go back to what, to the TV and everything we'd done before, because we just all raised up to a whole new level. And the phone went one day and it was what had become Leica. So Will Vinton Studios had changed into Leica. They had been working with Henry Selick for a couple of years on a short film, and they had just greenlit Coraline. And they needed somebody with more feature experience to head up the puppet department. And they didn't approach Pete and Ian, MacKinnon and Saunders, because they knew that they were a company. They wanted somebody that would start a puppet department at Leica and grow with the studio. So they reached out to me, and I think I was one of a couple of people that they interviewed. They definitely interviewed the head of skeleton puppet department that had done Nightmare and everything. But I think because I just literally finished the Corpse Bride, and Anthony Scott had worked with me, and he was going to be head of animation on Coraline. So he put a good word in, and there were several other animators that knew me that put my name forward. I got the job, and I couldn't, as terrifying as it was and as hard as it was to leave all my friends and family behind, I had to do it. It was the opportunity of a lifetime.
Did you ever think you would be staying?
No, it was a year and a half contract. And, 3.5 years later, when we finally finished Coraline, of course, I've got a boyfriend at that point, and the Portland way of life was just amazing. I loved it. And, suddenly I was like, oh, I don't want to go back to Manchester. What would I do in Manchester? I owned a house still in Manchester with my friend, but I just left all of that. It was like, I'm just going to go for a year and I'll be back, you know, 3.5 years later. But yeah, basically, after Coraline, they, Leica, asked me to stay. It's like, no, we want to build a studio. And even though we haven't got any projects, we want to keep you for the next project. So I had about 8 months of doing R&D and prepping for Paranorman. And then, of course, I then stayed for 12 and a half years.
It seems to be a running thing every 12 and a half years. Let's make a change. But okay. So, I mean, you know, we've talked a little bit about the course of your career, and I wanted to ask you about the different parts of, you know, what you do, because so you went to school, you learned how to do puppet making, and that's such a big umbrella of things. And for, you know, for a lot of people, myself included, that's really overwhelming. So like there's all these little specialties for you. Can you talk a little bit about, give us some insight into that sort of process? And for you, what is your favorite part of that process?
You know, when I first started, I had all these different skills. And in a way, my work placement at Mackinnon and Saunders really helped inform me and at Colesgrove Hall at that point. I started to weirdly excel in an area that I'd never even done before, which was the armature making, the internal skeleton part of it. And I was fast. I'm being the sports person, so I mentioned I loved sport as well. I've got this competitive streak in me that makes me want to win and want to be faster. So that kind of helps when you're working on production line and having the skill set. So I mainly, at the beginning of my stop motion career, was an armature maker. Pete Saunders trained me. I sat on the corner of his desk, and for about a year, all I was allowed to do was make hands. And then I remember one day he gave me a foot. He's like, I think you can make this foot armature. I made one, I'll talk you through the other. So he allowed me to do that. And then I remember doing my first body armature, but also when I was at college, I'd made a body armature. They taught me how. So, you know, I got to know. So very quickly, I picked up armature building. And I think that what allowed me to pick it up so quickly was my understanding of every other part of the process as well. I knew that you can't just think of an armature without thinking about the bigger picture of the puppet. And I think the reason I enjoyed armature making is, as the person that's building the internal skeleton, you are essentially, you're not in charge of that puppet, but you have to have an overview of it, because your armature is going to inform how everything on the outside moves. You've got to interact with the animator to find out what they need from it. It's also got to, it can't hinder the costume, so you've got to have an understanding of costumes and how fabrics sit over the top and all of the materials. So there's a lot more to armature making. And I think what I realized is that my brain, I have a creative problem solving brain. That's what I enjoy doing the most. And being the armature maker, you've got most of the problems right there in front of you. Shit, how am I going to make this thing move frame by frame? Well, I need to talk to this person, and I need to get input from this person. So that's what I did for the first, I would say, 2 and a bit years at Colesgrove Hall. I was an assistant armature maker, then became part of the armature team. And then they ran out of work. And I was taken on by a model making company called Barrow Model Makers. Barrow Model Makers was one woman. And I became the other woman who was the person. She hired me because she knew I had learned everything in the puppet department. And basically, it was my job to build everything that she brought in through the door. And she was a set builder by training. But basically, she also wanted to learn my skill set. And we worked on Barry Purb's films. We worked on screenplay in which I sculpted 90% of the puppets. I then molded all of those puppets. I then made the armatures for them. The only part of the puppets I didn't do were the costumes. I made all of the fans for the film. We made the sets. We hired one person to make the sets. I mean, it was crazy, crazy time. We would do all-nighters. You know, she would take these big jobs on without really understanding how many people you might need or whatever. So, and it was a nightmare. I worked for her for 2 years and we did not have a good relationship. But what it did, what it taught me was a bigger understanding of everybody's part in the process. And I also saw very quickly how schedules work and how they can fall apart so quickly, you know. So I always say that as much as I wished I had never worked at that place because she was a bully, I learned more in 2 years there than I learned anywhere else. And it allowed me to see, have to understand the bigger picture of a puppet build, not just the armature, every part of it. I was doing every bit of it and seeing what bits take a long time, what you can do fast, you know. And then going back to MacKinnon and Saunders, I got kind of like pushed back into armature because that's what I had excelled at before. So I actually left Barrow Model Makers. I just said, okay, I'm done. I'm moving on. But then it was just as MacKinnon and Saunders had become MacKinnon and Saunders, and they signed a deal to make the first Cabbage Patch film, which were these short films. So I went back. My contract, I think, was something like 3 months, and I was there for 12 years. And I think because of the 2 years that I'd had at Barrow Model Makers, when I went back to MacKinnon's, I just went back at a different level. I had so much more experience, and I would get bored if I was just doing armature making or if I was just one of the cogs in the wheel. So I always was suggesting things or helping Pete and Ian with the organization of things, and well, I can do that and I can do this. And so I think that's where my skill set of running a department came from. It was obviously there anyway because of my personality, but I had the knowledge at that point as well to add to the personality.
This actually brings up an interesting question that I had for you, and that is, dealing with groups and leading groups, because I mean, as the head of a department, you have a whole group of people that you're dealing with, and from your experience, it's not always fun to work with some people, right? Do you have some like tips for folks that might be working in an environment where they might not get along with their coworker or their boss, or maybe you have an employee that you don't really get along with?
Yeah, I mean, my tip has always been to be true to yourself. You know, for me, I was always true to myself, and also know that we are all made up of different DNA. We're never all gonna agree and have the same idea to go in the same direction. But communication is the key, but good communication. It's really hard to come up with recommendations of because people are who they are. I would say after being a puppet maker for too many years now and also being a manager of artists, I think always try and think there are so many ways to tackle a creative problem, you know, or a creative task. And the solution that one person comes up with is never going to be the only one and the right solution. There could be six different solutions that are all going to get you to the end result, but they have different minds working out those solutions. Just be aware of that, because I do think, you know, especially kids that come out of college now, trained to be almost idealistic, and they're right. And that can actually be to their detriment, because if they have to work with the team, you have to listen to the other person's ideas and suggestions. So, yeah, working with the team is not easy. Also, one thing that I've really seen youngsters struggle with, and I think it comes from what some of the courses that they've been on, is accepting that when you've left college, there are very few people that are going to become a director overnight. You have to get into the industry and work your way up, and being realistic as well as to what budgets are. And, I mean, I worked at a studio that was connected with a global footwear, running shoe designer name. And because of that, a lot of kids came out of college and they just wanted to work at that studio and get on the first rung of the ladder, because they were gonna climb the ladder just like you would do at the parent company. But it was a very different entity. The studio was really living out of the back pocket of the big entity, until we made a movie that could stand on its own 2 feet and brought in the money. There wasn't that much money to make those movies. And I think it always amazed me how many people just didn't see that. They just didn't see that. They saw a corporate structure, so had expectations beyond what it was going to deliver. And at times they did advertise those expectations, so I can see why. But I never, and maybe it was the time that I went to college and left college, it was, it was way back there, not in the 90s. I never had expectations of making money and having pay rises. I just wanted to learn, and I had this naivety that, oh, you're going to pay me? This is great. And I was paid like crap to start with for years. But we were treated really well. Like at MacKinnon and Saunders, we were treated incredibly well. So I never questioned it. And it's only when you do get into a corporate structure you start to question it. But yeah, it's definitely my advice to young kids is you need to work hard to get where. I've worked hard. I've tried to listen well, and I try to do the best I possibly can. And I still, at the end of every project, think I could have done something better. That's also what then informs you to do the next one. You're always learning.
Yeah, it's not an overnight success. It's a success 20 some odd years in the making.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Talking about learning from mistake and always looking for the next way to make the next project better, can we talk a little bit about the technology and that how that has changed? Because I expect that over the course of, your career, you've seen the way that puppets are made, used, captured, filmed. Has changed so dramatically.
Dramatically, yeah. I mean, I love it, and I've never been afraid of. The funny thing is, I was known at MacKinnon's as the Queen Luddite of MacKinnon and Saunders, and I was a real anti-technology. The Luddites went and smashed the looms in the mills, in the cotton, cotton mills. I was up for smashing the computers up. I mean, I think I was a higher intelligence to most of my colleagues because I realized they were going to take our jobs. So I was like totally, and I hated having to. I mean, it's writing, but it's worse than writing. It's having to use this flipping key. Anyway, if for some reason it didn't make me anti anybody else bringing it to the table. So I was always open and fascinated. Did I want to become a computer expert? No. And you know what? To this day, I hardly ever write emails. I, as you know, I have never got into any of the computer part of animation. I'm still hands-on. Even if I'm not hands-on making, I'm one-to-one personal contact, art directing, not through an email, through being in the same room. But am I against what has happened? No, it's been amazing. And what it has done with technology, as you mentioned, on the stages and in the fabrication departments, being able to embrace that technology has really allowed our medium of animation to stand in a world that's ever growing and changing. So, once the Pixar movies came out, it's like, oh shit, how's stop motion ever still going to be able to stand next to that? Well, then 3D printing came along. And what 3D printing did, I mean, at times, and I think for me, some of the use of 3D printing in facial animation has taken stop motion beyond what stop motion should be. It's almost too smooth, too realistic. But having those printers to help sort of streamline and mechanize some of the fabrication builds and to push the art form, push the ability of performance so that you can. There's so many different ways that you can do stop motion now. And what's interesting is, I was at Leica, being a part of the big push with 3D printing and being my head being blown away every sort of on every film we would come up with some new technological, leap. But then I did start to feel that the end result of the movies was just too polished and too, it was just a bit too smooth. Then Pinocchio comes along, and Guillermo del Toro, one of the first things he said was, I don't want it to be replacement because I don't want that. I want it to look like stop motion. I want mechanical. Which, at that point was seen antiquated. Oh, who would ever do mechanical now that we've got this? But Guillermo was like, no, I want to do mechanical. What was interesting is having done and seen stop motion from the last 10 years being the performance of the characters being pushed and pushed and pushed through 3D printed faces. What it did with the expectations of the animators and Guillermo, they just expected a lot more out of the mechanical faces than had ever been expected before. And they pushed those mechanical faces to a whole new level of performance than had ever been done before. So collectively, you've got something that still looks stop motion, but suddenly all of the press, it's like there's this new sort of fangled, like amazing technique that they're using on Pinocchio. It's mechanical faces. It's like, oh yeah. It's from the Dark Ages, actually. But because, and we, there would always be this, you can't help when a whole load of you have worked at a studio and you've all left and you're at a new studio. Well, we're not doing it that way. We're doing it all different. But we all were in agreement that without all of those years of Leica, the quality of what we produce on Pinocchio would never have been what it was. The expectations would never have been there, and then all of the years of knowledge and growth would never have been there. I think it's fascinating, and I don't like it when everything gets so perfect that you can't see a stop motion anymore. But I think because of its physicality, most of the time you can tell as long as you don't, put a CG effect on every single shot, you can tell. So yeah. And then on the stage, even though I don't have as much to do with the stages day to day, when I started, it was 16 mil or 35 mil film. And there was no way you were gonna, there was video assist towards the latter sort of stages at Cosgrove Hall, there was a video assist so you could very crudely see the frame that you had done before. But now with Dragon Frame and the digital, digital cameras, it's a whole different fog and the lighting. You know, we're now with LED lights, so you can light a room with miniature lighting that doesn't flicker because it's LED. You can control it. And yeah, it's mad.
Your way of leadership is like hands-on, like one-on-one, like face-to-face. How did the pandemic affect that? And now that we're in this place where it's become normal to communicate, not in the same room, like Zoom has become like a given, right? How do you get around that?
So we were in lockdown for only 3 months in the studio. And let me tell you, the first person to go back into the studio was me. With a small group of people that felt comfortable. You know, it was really our choice. And at that point, even before COVID lockdown, because we were working with McKinnon and Saunders on Pinocchio, we had to set in place ways that we could review puppets, how we could talk to them, give feedback notes. So we were doing Zoom and Google Hangout before lockdown even happened, but with, you know, overseas. So we just expanded that to our own crew. And I mean, the difference was our own crew were in their living room or in their bedroom or in their basement or in their garden, soldier, you know. So we carried on doing face-to-face launches and stuff to keep people going. And then, as I say, as soon as we could, we all went back into the studio. So, and a lot, I think the majority of us wanted to be back in the studio because it's way easier. One of the things I would say with puppet makers, with artists in general, the hardest thing to drum into a puppet maker is that they have to work as a team. They can't make the puppet from start to finish, especially on a feature film. And that they have to communicate and be aware of what the rest of the team needs from them and what they've got to give to them. So when suddenly you're all in your own little houses and your own little comfort zone, that makes that really hard. So it was a bigger job for the coordinators. And I have an amazing production manager. And I see us as a team. You know, I don't think you ever have a head of puppets without a right... For a feature especially, you need all of the sort of the production people who are doing all the shit that you really don't have the time to do, doing all of the schedules, doing all the computer stuff, you know. I've been allowed to be the creative and at times the maker that I want to be. And I have to say that for a short while, towards the end of, well, a lot of the time at Leica, because it got so big, I never got to be hands-on. I would be in meetings with the puppet makers problem-solving at the beginning, but I was in meetings 24/7, so I never got to make anything myself and grow in my own knowledge and experience. And I do think that's really important for a creative leader to still be hands-on and to feel part of the team, because I think you get more respect from the team as well.
And at times that means taking chances, right? I mean, and stepping out of your comfort zone.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, I'm definitely not scared of taking chances. I wouldn't be here now if I wasn't crazy, stupid, brave, all those things. Yeah.
You also strike me as an adventurer. It's wonderful. You have this real passion for, you know, exploration and getting out into nature and wilderness. Has that always been a part of your life, or did that develop later?
Always been a part of my life. As a child, my dad worked at Rolls-Royce in the aero engine division. He was a servicing electrician. Anyway, he, whenever he got a chance for a vacation, wanted to escape it all, escape the bureaucracy. So we would be thrown in the back of a car with a caravan on the back, and we would drive to the furthermost point of the west coast of Scotland. And he'd be like, we're escaping, girls. So it'd be me, my sister and my mum. And it's in my blood. So I was taken to a place that's wilder than anywhere I've ever since been, and fell in love with it. You're so in tune with nature and it's so creatively inspiring. Whenever I'm feeling dead and buried with creativity, I will always take myself out onto a mountain or, onto the side of the ocean. And preferably, I don't want anybody there. I'm a terrible beach girl. I'm just like, what does anybody do on a beach? And there's all these people. I like to hike a wild, rugged coastline where there is nobody and just be at one with nature. But yeah, I'm a total explorer. And that's another reason why I came to Portland, Oregon. It's, when I was offered the job, I also looked at what Oregon was. God, it looks beautiful, and I turned up with a bag of clothes and my mountain bike.
Priorities.
And I've always seen that as a really important life balance as well. I have to say, I'm not one that this isn't the everything of my life. I need my weekends, I need my evenings, I need my George time. Away from the studio. And that's, I think, what keeps me who I am, keeps me enthusiastic, keeps me with fresh ideas. I think it's an important part of it.
About somebody that loves to create and make things, what are you making in your free time? Like what gets you excited?
Yeah, so I actually love making clothes. I pattern my own clothes and I make my own clothes. And then I've always got an art project that's going on. For a short time in between leaving Leica and starting on Pinocchio, I was building a series of fabric sculptural horses that I was hand painting. I collect folk art, and it's funny because most of the art that I do myself is really uptight and, it's very photorealist and it's copying things that are in, reality. And yet my life ambition is to be able to paint a stick figure that looks like a 3-year-old's painted it. And, it's never going to happen. That's what's all over my wall at home. So these horses were kind of folk art inspired, but they were my own version of it. And then I have a cabin up in, I'm part of a commune from the 70s that a communal living situation. And that there's always something creative up there that I'm working on. I found a whole load of circular saw blades that I intend to paint and in a folk arty kind of way. It's
Okay, so as the girl that never liked going to the rummage sales with your dad, what does he think now?
Well, he's not with us, but luckily he was with us long enough to see that whole thing turn around and to see my house full of old shit. I have the DNA for sure.
You had a really interesting way into your career and to where you are today. And you've talked a little bit about, some suggestions for young people that want to get into creative fields. If you had one thing that you could tell them, what would that one thing be?
Believe in yourself as an artist and that there is a world for you out there. Don't be influenced by anybody trying to push you into an area that you're not comfortable with. If you are an artist and if you want to get a job in the arts, be it animation, be it magazines, be it anything in the arts, do it. Go for it.
And that was our conversation with the director of puppet fabrication at Shadow Machine, Georgina Hines. You can find out more about the work Georgina's currently working on at the Shadow Machine website at shadowmachine.com. The Sparkcast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlund. Editing and additional production support by Joshua Peterman. For more about SparkCG and our upcoming events, visit sparkcg.org.